Chapter 7. Quote, "Oh, the sin of writing such words. Words which are clear as crystal, limpid and musical as bubbling springs. Words which sparkle and glow like the poisoned diamonds of the Medicis. Oh, the wickedness, the hopeless damnation of a soul who could fascinate and paralyze human creatures with such words. Words understood by the ignorant and wise alike. Words which are more precious than jewels, more soothing than heavenly music, more awful than death itself." End quote. Robert W. Chambers, The Yellow Sign, 1895. Who knew that hell was a black Plymouth convertible parked on a West Hollywood sidewalk? One version of hell, anyway. The one Jack was trapped in right now. A member of his team needed him. Daniel needed him. And Jack was just sitting here with his leg propped up across the back seat. The southern horizon was smoldering red. Men continued to stumble along the sidewalk from one darkened bar to the next. And the people who had dragged Daniel from that wrecked rental car were getting further away with every passing minute. Yelling at Wyndham Price would have been briefly satisfying, but Jack had to admit that wouldn't accomplish anything. Besides, as frustrating as their current circumstances were, this was the first time he found himself actually agreeing, at least a little bit, with the priorities of Angel and his odd band of associates. Of course, they had to find Cordelia first. You never left one of your own behind. "Angel should have been back by now," Wesley burst out suddenly. "The weight must be getting to him, too."
"You think he's in trouble?"
"Angel? Not very likely." Wesley crossed his arms over his chest and glared hard at the next beautiful young man, beer in hand, who did a double take as he passed the car. At Wesley's growl, the young man hurried on without speaking. "What I'm afraid is that he can't find Cordy." "Damn it, surely she wouldn't go wandering around by herself while the city's going up in smoke." His tone said it was exactly the sort of thing he might expect Cordelia to do. "I want to ask you something." He turned to look squarely back at Jack. "Your friends down in Santa Monica, they're military, aren't they?"
"Oh?"
"When we found you, you asked us to call someone named Major Carter."
"Must be getting old," Jack thought. "A car crash, little shift in reality, and some swine with human faces," and he threw elementary precautions to the wind.
"You are too, aren't you?" Wesley pressed when Jack didn't answer him.
"I don't think you're retired at all."
"And Dr. Jackson as well?" In the flashing car headlights, Jack saw Wesley's face twist. "Angel was right all along. You were just using us to get to the Ishikido manuscript. And now Cordelia's missing and Los Angeles is burning and you act like none of this is your fault."
"Hey," Jack interrupted. "You people are the ones who kept that chunk of green rock sitting around like an ashtray. If it weren't for Daniel's translation, we wouldn't have any idea what was going on now."
"The police are here," Wesley interrupted, pointing back down the street.
"About damn time," Jack thought, turning to look.
Two uniformed officers were making their way down the sidewalk. They would have radios. He could finally report Daniel's abduction, find Carter and Teal'c. "Help me up," he demanded, pushing open the back door and struggling to get out. His bad ankle wouldn't support his weight,
and the pain of trying to stand made his head swim. When his vision cleared, Wesley had his hands on Jack's shoulders and was easing him back into the car.
"I've got a better idea. You sit still and I'll bring the police here."
Jack nodded impatiently. "Hurry." He looked back, then grabbed Wesley's sleeve. "Hold on."
"What is it now?"
"I'm not sure," Jack said. "There's something happening down there."
"Yes, I believe that would be Los Angeles going up in flames."
Jack didn't bother to respond to that.
"I mean the other guys. Who are they? They're not cops."
Behind and on either side of the uniformed officers were men in civilian clothes, blending in with the crowd with all the subtlety of the Secret Service.
"Or NID agents."
"No," Wesley said slowly. "No, I don't believe they are policemen." They were looking for him, Jack knew instinctively. What's more, he was very, very certain he didn't want to be found.
"Help me into that club," he demanded.
"What?" Wesley looked at Jack and then back at the closest bar. All the doors were open to the sidewalk, and the only light came from the red emergency lighting in the back. A tinny backbeat from music playing on a boombox thumped over the din of voices, and Jack could smell sweat and warm beer.
"I thought you wanted to talk to the police," Wesley said.
"Changed my mind. They were sitting ducks if they stayed out here."
"We don't have time for this now," Jack insisted. "Help me."
Wesley darted a glance over his shoulder.
"They're looking for you."
"I can't help Daniel if they find me."
"I don't believe this," Wesley complained, but finally he bent down to pull Jack's arm over his shoulders.
"Act like you're drunk."
"Not a problem," Jack hissed, staggering as Wesley helped him to his feet.
"They're close." Jack nodded his understanding. Steadying himself with one hand on Wesley's opposite shoulder, he pulled himself around until he was facing him.
"Nothing personal," he muttered, then leaned in and planted one squarely on Wesley's frowning lips.
For an instant, Wesley stood frozen, but just about the time Jack was starting to think he was going to end up with his ass dumped on the sidewalk, Wesley's arms went around him, and he pulled Jack into a kiss that would have done any leading man proud. His mouth came down over Jack's, lips grinding hard enough to bruise, and he bent Jack over his arm at an angle that made Jack's upper back ache. He clutched at Wesley's sleeves, a little concerned about the man's ability to support him in this position. Finally, Wesley's hand went to the back of Jack's head, and he eased him upwards again, only the faintest tremor in his shoulders betraying the strain.
"Let's get you a drink, lover," Wesley rasped loudly.
Jack nodded, keeping his head down and wishing he knew where the NID agents were. Probably close. Wesley raised his hand and ruffled Jack's hair, effectively hiding Jack's face with his arm. And when they had made their way through the crowd to the entrance of the club, Wesley pushed him up against the doorpost and kissed him again. It was a relief for Jack to rest against the wall, and Wesley's kiss was much gentler against Jack's numbed lips this time, now that he wasn't taxed with supporting Jack's entire weight. Finally, he nudged Jack's head to the side and whispered in his ear, "They're past us. Still want to go in?" Jack continued to resist the urge to look for himself.
"At least until we're sure they're gone."
Wesley nodded, his cheek to Jack's.
"I just need a moment."
He was breathing hard. Jack remembered the bullet wound Gunn had mentioned and wondered if Wesley were completely healed from it. If he collapsed now, Jack would be helpless. He nuzzled Wesley's face and leaned forward to ask, "Sure you can do this?"
"I'm fine."
Wesley drew back, sounding affronted.
"Let's go."
Jack put his arm over his shoulders again and allowed Wesley to lead him into the darkness of the club. They were instantly surrounded by bodies, shirtless, sweating, bumping up against them. Jack was forced to lean harder on Wesley to avoid being knocked to the ground. The air was thick with cologne and stale beer, and the dull red light from the exit signs obliterated individual features.
"Back wall," Wesley whispered breathlessly. "You can rest there."
Jack nodded, trying to stay focused, even though the pain of walking on his bad ankle made his vision blur. He wondered if the men surrounding him knew this was the end of the world. Maybe they did. There were worse ways to go than dancing the apocalypse away, or screwing it away. Wesley finally reached the wall near the bathrooms, and on one side of them, two men were caressing a third, who lay back in their embraces, shirtless, languorous with pleasure. Jack turned his head the other way and found his face only inches from a man who was being slowly and seriously fucked up against the wall. His eyes were squeezed shut, his fist clenched, and he beat the wall in time with his partner's strokes. Jack closed his eyes against a sluggish wave of arousal, unwanted and drearily impersonal. If he thought about Daniel right now, he'd probably start to cry. Or hit somebody. Then Wesley murmured, "They seem rather uninhibited." In such a clipped, dry voice, Jack was surprised into a snort of laughter. He opened his eyes and found himself blinded by the glare of a flashlight. Christ, they were back.
"Get down," Wesley said urgently. "Hurry up, just get on the floor."
He was pushing Jack down with one hand, supporting some of Jack's weight with the other as Jack painfully slid down the wall until he was kneeling on the sticky floor, clenching his teeth against the grinding sensation in his bad ankle.
"They're coming this way," Wesley hissed.
He leaned forward over Jack, propping himself against the wall with his forearm over his head. Jack got it. He yanked Wesley's shirt out of his jeans, unbuttoning the lower buttons so the flaps hung in his face. He unzipped his jeans and laid his face against Wesley's open fly. At once, Wesley cradled the back of Jack's head with his other hand and began to moan in gamely simulated passion. Jack pulled on his belt loops, and after a moment's hesitation, Wesley carefully rocked his hips forward, crowding Jack against the wall and hiding his face. He moaned more loudly, sounding pretty ridiculous, but not necessarily inauthentic.
When this was all over, Jack thought, if they survived and didn't end up spending the rest of their lives in NID holding cells somewhere far beneath the Nevada desert, and, oh yeah, if the world didn't end, he was really going to owe Wyndham Price a drink.
The tattered king had returned. He stood in the far corner of the nearly bare condominium living room, pudgy hands clasped under his lack of a chin, pallid skin glowing faintly in the darkness. Daniel didn't have to open his eyes to see him. He didn't even have to look in his direction. The mere insistence of his presence had imprinted itself into Daniel's flesh. The other man in the room, the hapless stranger who'd been trying to put on a play,
didn't seem to have noticed the silent third. Daniel had an absurd horror that he would eventually notice, and that a stranger and an outsider seeing Daniel's personal demon would just make the thing all that much more real. So he was rambling on like a man trying to hide a terrible guilt. The stain of agony spreading from his shoulder muddled his thoughts. His fingertips were going numb, and he worried the dislocation could have cut off the flow of blood or perhaps caused nerve damage. But it seemed a distant and unimportant concern next to the possibility that the man without a face might begin to talk to him once more. Tell me about the play. Who's the author? What's it about? Why did you decide to produce it? Who the actors are? Where the theater is? How long you've been planning this? I'm chattering like a damn magpie, Daniel thought, dazed and slightly hysterical. Maybe that'll give us a clue what the NID wants with you. Maybe a textual analysis would help too, the stranger snapped. Derrida, Foucault? Or are you one of those dreary prigs who feel de Man's writings in Le Soir irrevocably tarnished the entire postmodernist enterprise? For Christ's sake, man, that's not going to get us out of here. Daniel swallowed and closed his eyes. He felt the presence of the tattered king like a blast from an open meat locker. If you have another suggestion, I'm willing to listen, he said, though he really wasn't. If he started to listen, there was no telling what might be talking to him. Otherwise, I suppose we can both sit here and stare at each other in the dark. The stranger snorted and didn't answer. As the silence lengthened between them, Daniel felt panic beginning to build from his gut, and he was on the verge of bursting out with anything at all. Reciting the multiplication table in ancient Phoenician, anything to fill the void. When the other man said grudgingly, "It's Castaigne's King in Yellow, the most famous unperformed play in English." He shifted in his chair, pulling ineffectually at his handcuffs. "And likely to remain that way." "Castaigne," Daniel repeated. "I know that name from somewhere." "You'd know it if you'd ever made a study of the particularly ineffectual Fin de Siècle occultus. He was a minor member of Madame Blavatsky's circle, joined the Society for the Investigation of Paranormal Phenomenon, was even one of Crowley's sycophants for a short time. Though he wasn't much of an occultist, by all accounts he was a pretty fair scholar of ancient languages. Ancient Sumerian had barely been recognized as a distinct language by then, and no one knew what to make of a recently discovered tablet in that language. Castaigne couldn't translate it either, but he did use it as the basis of his single remembered piece of literary output, The King in Yellow." Daniel could feel his heart thudding in his chest. "Used the tablet. Used it how, exactly?" "The entire play is an elaborate pun. He couldn't translate the Sumerian ideograms, but he knew how to pronounce them. The King in Yellow is a phonetic transcription of the Sumerian tablet. The Sumerian syllables buried in English words. Quite clever, really." "Clever," Daniel echoed weakly. "Dear God." "This tablet. You're talking about the Ishikidu manuscript Randolph Carter found in Babylon in 1887, aren't you?" "So you do know what this is all about," the other man burst out furiously. "Bloody hell! What kind of game are you people playing at? Who are you, really? Did they send you in here to look like a fellow captive? Get my sympathy so I'd tell the people you work for everything?" You stupid bastard. I've got nothing to hide. All you had to do is ask.
All right, I'm asking, Daniel said wearily, seeing no point in trying to argue with the man. The King in Yellow is actually the Ishikido manuscript read aloud. His stomach turned over as he tried to grasp the implications. I can see why it's never been performed.
Castaigne tried. Supposedly his actors all went insane trying to learn their lines.
And you thought it would be a good idea to try again? Daniel said incredulously.
That's just a story. Fairy tales, like the legends that have sprung up around Aleister Crowley. The dreary truth is Castaigne was a drunk who didn't know how to manage his money, and the production folded before opening night.
Good Christ, is that why I'm here? Your government actually believes those old ghost stories.
If you don't believe them, why did you want to put on the play?
It's a living piece of theatrical history. Have you even read my press release?
The inner door burst open, and flashlights threw harsh beams across the floor.
All right, said one of their captors. Time to get this show on the road.
Please listen to me, Daniel said. This is extremely important. The King in Yellow is very, very dangerous. Don't let anyone look at it. Whatever you do, don't let anyone read or recite from it aloud.
Is that your advice, Dr. Jackson?
Whatever you're trying to do here, you've got to stop. I know you think the Ishikido manuscript explains how the Revenuers defeated the Goa Uld, and maybe it does, but you've got to believe me, the price is too high. The Revenuers did it by awakening their sleeping god, and it drove every sentient species in the galaxy insane. Do you have any idea how long it took mankind to climb back down from the trees the last time?
The gold, said the producer. The Revenuers?
That's fascinating, Dr. Jackson. Another of the NID agents walked up to him, pulling a handkerchief from his pocket. He wadded it into a ball and proceeded to cram it into Daniel's mouth, despite his furious protests. But we'll let you know when we're in need of your expert opinion.
Quote, among the Assyrians, the Ikemu might appear in a house. Just as the vampire, it would pass through walls or doors, and whether it merely glided about as a silent phantom, or whether it gibbered, uttering unintelligible and mocking words with hideous mop and mow, or whether it seemed to ask some question that required a response. In any case, such an apparition was terribly unlucky. End quote. The Vampire, His Kith and Kin. Montague Summers, 1928.
That popping sound out on the street might have been gunfire, but Sam continued to hold the little penlight from her bag steady.
Is he showing any signs of coming out of it? We've got to find Paul and Blair, and it sounds like a war zone out there.
It sounds rather like frightened civilians in the throes of panic.
Tilk put two fingers under Ellison's throat.
But I concur with your assessment of our immediate priorities. As far as Detective Ellison's physical status, his pulse is very rapid, so I do not believe he is suffering from the zone-out effect.
The zone-out effect?
You have not read Dr. Sandberg's dissertation.
No, I didn't get around to that.
Around them, the restaurant was largely empty, most of the customers and staff having fled into the night. Tilk and Sam had tipped their table on its end and were crouched behind the makeshift barrier. Tilk gently shifted Ellison's shoulders, pulling him around until his head was resting on Tilk's thigh. He held Ellison's right hand with his own and let his left hand cover Ellison's forehead.
"You do not believe Detective Ellison actually possesses the abilities imputed to him?"
"I don't disbelieve in them. I simply think that some pretty extraordinary claims have been made, and the only evidence is the word of a single researcher."
"Daniel Jackson has attested to Detective Ellison's abilities as well."
"The NID was lobbing tear gas canisters at Daniel at the time. Not the best circumstances for making impartial observations."
"Tilk, look, the only thing that matters now is whether Jim is going to come out of this on his own or if we need to get him medical attention."
"I do not know."
Tilk sounded unhappy.
"I believe Detective Ellison may have been overwhelmed when we suddenly found ourselves on P3X-636, and that his current non-responsiveness is a necessary form of self-protection. Dr. Sandberg has documented instances when it took several days for Detective Ellison's senses to resume their normal functioning."
"Several days?" Sam mentally ran through their immediate options. None of them were good.
"It is indeed unfortunate that Dr. Sandberg has become separated from us, since his assistance in evaluating Detective Ellison's condition would be invaluable." "An irony, given that Detective Ellison would be capable of finding Blair Sandberg for us, were he not unconscious."
Tilk bent closer over Jim and patted his cheek.
"Detective Ellison," he said formally, "we are in need of your immediate assistance."
Sam didn't know if it were just her imagination, but Jim seemed to tense. Tilk went on.
"Blair Sandberg is in need of your assistance."
And this time there was no mistake. His back arched from the floor and his fingers tightened around Tilk's hand. Sam reached forward to take Jim's other hand. Jim's eyes opened, and then he turned his face away at once, squinting against her penlight. She hastily shut it off. "Jim, Detective Ellison, are you all right?"
"They've got Blair," he said in a low, rasping voice.
"What? Who's got Blair?" Jim kept his face turned away, his eyes clamped shut.
"I thought the NID wanted me," he whispered.
And Sam wasn't sure if he was answering her question or not.
"Why did they take Sandberg instead?"
"I think it's been long enough," Wesley finally muttered down to Jack. "They're gone."
"About damn time," Jack groaned.
"Can you help me up?"
"I've got you. Careful."
Wesley wrapped his fists in the shoulders of Jack's shirt and hauled him to his feet. Jack collapsed against the wall, panting as he waited for the sharpest pain in his ankle to subside. The amorous groups on both sides had changed while he'd been on the floor, and the batteries in the portable stereo that had been supplying the music all this time were beginning to give out. No one particularly seemed to notice.
"Is there a back way out of this place?"
"Probably," Wesley said, adjusting his clothes. His hands seemed a little shaky to Jack. "There's an alley that feeds into the pavilion's parking lot. We should be able to go around that way and catch up with Angel." He pulled Jack's arm over his shoulder.
"You sure you can make it?"
"I could find Angel myself, and we could meet you back here."
The two men next to Jack had each other's jeans pulled down around their respective knees and were necking so enthusiastically they kept bumping into him. Jack didn't turn his head to see what was happening on the other side, but he could hear the creaking of a leather jacket.
"I can make it," he said firmly.
The back exit had a panic bar across it and a large sign Jack couldn't read in the red emergency lighting. Someone had thoughtfully propped the door open with an empty case of Absolute. Leaning heavily on Wesley, Jack stuck his head out and looked around. The alley was very dark, but hardly quiet, with tinny dance music coming from all the other clubs on this side of the street. A group of men had evidently taken the party outside and were making out near the dumpster.
"Think we're clear," Jack said. But as he and Wesley limped their way down the alley, one of the men by the dumpster called out, "Hey, what's your hurry?"
And suddenly he and Wesley were surrounded. A skinny kid in a mesh t-shirt and hip-hugging jeans planted himself in front of them and thumped Wesley on the chest.
"I saw you inside, dude, and I know you didn't get your money's worth in there."
"Touched as I am by your concern," Wesley said, "I can hardly see how that's any of your business."
"Nah, it's freaking me out. Really."
A second kid, who looked no older than the first, put his arm around the shoulders of his friend, mirroring the way Wesley was supporting Jack.
"You look like your type, but you're in there faking it. What's that all about?"
"Are you cops?"
The voice from behind them was an exaggerated falsetto.
"LA's going up in smoke, and you're down here looking to bust us for indecency?"
"For fuck's sake," Jack burst out,
and it wasn't hard to sound furious, especially not as angry and exasperated as he really was.
"We're not cops. Now, it's already been one shitty kind of a night, and believe me, you fellas are not improving my temper. So do you want to get the hell out of our way?"
The two kids in front exchanged a look. Neither of them seemed in the least intimidated, and none of the others showed any signs of backing off either.
"If you must know," Wesley tried, "and not that it's any of your business, but we were just trying to make my boyfriend jealous."
"I don't know," said one of the boys.
He tilted his head back, and his nostrils twitched as though he were sniffing the air. Something about the gesture sent a weird chill down Jack's spine. "Don't you think a whiff of spunk would make your boyfriend way more jealous than a fake blowjob?" Giggles came out of the darkness.
"Okay," Jack thought. At this point, the situation had officially gone from absurd to downright freakish.
Wesley evidently thought the same thing.
"Come on, Jack," he said, rearranging Jack's arm over his shoulder and straightening his back to support more of his weight.
"Let's go."
"Oh man, there's no hurry," said the kid in the mesh shirt. "Haven't you heard? It's the end of the world."
He reached forward and wrapped his fists in Jack's shirt, and then, to Jack's utter amazement, violently yanked him forward.
"Idiot," Jack thought, enraged by the kid's audacity and by the stab of pain as his full weight came down on his busted ankle.
He brought his hands up to knock the kid off him, but his hands rebounded off skinny forearms that were as immovable as steel cables.
"Christ!"
He drew back his fist for a punch, much as he hated having to hit a stupid, drunk child, even one who was strong as an ox. And in that moment of hesitation, the kid hauled him forward and snapped him around. Jack's bad ankle made him clumsy, and the kid was freakishly fast. The next thing he knew, he was trapped in a full Nelson, the kid's arms wrapped around Jack's, his hands locked at the back of Jack's neck.
"Easy there, sugar," someone said, snickering. Wesley was struggling furiously in the grip of three of the boys.
We're just helping you out here, making your boyfriend really jealous. The kid behind Wesley grinned wolfishly at Jack over Wesley's shoulder, running his hands over his chest. Wes was fighting like a madman, but Jack forced himself to stop. There was something ludicrously wrong here. Some part of the puzzle he just wasn't getting. He'd gone hand to hand with Jaffa warriors who weren't as unyieldingly strong as this pack of waifish teenage boys. Mindlessly flailing away at their attackers clearly wasn't helping the situation. The kid, fondling Wesley, suddenly hissed and snatched his hand away. In the next moment, he'd ripped Wesley's shirt from his shoulders. "Leave him alone," Jack said quietly, and the kid raised his head as he tore a long stripe from Wesley's already ripped shirt and proceeded to wrap it around his hand. "You breeders started it," the kid told Jack, and thrust his wrapped hand into Wesley's front pocket to pull out a small wooden cross, which he threw away with a growl of disgust. He went back to touching Wesley as his companions held him, running his hands down his body, nuzzling the side of his face. "I think I know you," he said. "You're one of Angel's little mortal buds, aren't you?" "He'll destroy you for this," Wesley said calmly. "He'll hunt you down one by one like the animals you are, and it won't be a nice clean steak when he finds you either. He'll string you up from a lamppost, leave you swinging to wait for dawn." So they were dealing with personal acquaintances of Angel's here, Jack thought. Somehow he wasn't in the least surprised. "And what will he do when we send you after him?" the kid purred. "Do you think Angel will save the nice clean steak for you?" The boy holding Jack was grinding his hips against him with easy, half-bored lasciviousness. His body was cold, seeming to leech the warmth from Jack where they touched. Despite the force he was exerting to restrain Jack, pulling backwards until Jack's shoulders and neck burned with the strain, the kid wasn't even breathing hard. The boy holding Wesley stuck out his tongue and licked a long stripe up the side of his neck. Wesley closed his eyes. "Don't drink, Jack," he said, raising his voice and betraying the faintest tremor in it. "No matter what they do, I have to believe it's possible not to drink." "Everybody drinks." The kid made a guttural growl, and Jack saw something impossible happen to his face. The pressure against the back of Jack's neck suddenly relaxed. He struck out furiously, but cold, pitilessly strong hands seized him at once and bore him down. He felt gritty asphalt under his back and a weight on his chest. The face suddenly thrust against his own wasn't human. Jack heaved himself upwards, but there were too many hands holding him down. The cold thing above him laid its monstrous face against Jack's. "Ever gotten off just before you died, man?" A skeletal hand fumbled at his crotch. The creature put his lips on the side of Jack's neck. "Guess not," it breathed, giggling again. "It's sort of a once-in-a-lifetime deal." The kisses became more insistent as Jack writhed, unable to keep himself from fighting now. He felt the bony ridge of the forehead pressing behind his ear, keeping his head turned to the side and exposing his throat. Wesley was shouting as the thing on top of Jack sucked a little bit of skin into its mouth, and then bit down with teeth like razors. "Vampires," Jack thought as his back came up off the pavement and a roar of pain and rage escaped him. "God damn it! Of all the crazy-ass things in this crazy-ass universe, now he had to deal with vampires, too." The thing on top of him began sucking at the small wound, probing it with its tongue. Jack's very soul convulsed in loathing. It wasn't as bad as feeling a snake munch its way into you, but it was pretty goddamn close. And then the weight on his chest was gone. Jack instinctively clamped his hand over his throat and struggled to sit up. Wesley was half-collapsed against the side of the dumpster, his own hand pressed to his throat, his glasses missing, and, in the midst of the boys, was Angel, looking like a terrier loosed on a pack of rats. Taking one boy by the shoulders, he shook him so hard Jack heard the snap of his neck. He flung a second up against the wall with strength that clearly wasn't human, and when he turned, Jack saw Angel's own face wasn't human right now either. The other boys were running, and Angel tossed something after them with easy practice. One of them went rigid, arms outflung, and then he simply wasn't there anymore. There was a brief smell in the air, like a draft from a musty basement. Jack closed his eyes. He'd gotten pretty good at this over the years, but damn it, even he needed a second or two to manage a paradigm shift of quite this magnitude. And when he opened them again, he was just in time to see Wesley making his way rather shakily to the bodies of the two boys on the ground. They were both starting to stir, which was clearly as impossible as everything else tonight, because Jack had just seen Angel appear out of nowhere and kill them. "It's a clean steak for you after all," Wesley said. He sounded more sad than vindictive, and as Jack watched, he put a fat, sharpened stick against the chest of the first boy and shoved hard. He did the same to the second. The smell of mold and dry rot suddenly became much stronger. Jack coughed, then gagged, understanding what he was smelling. Angel stalked back to them. His face was monstrous, but his voice was testy and utterly human. "I leave you alone for 5 minutes, and you stumble into an entire nest? Come on, Wesley, you know they're going to be out in force on a night like this." "We had other problems," Wesley said, sounding affronted. "There's some sort of government secret service types on the street looking for Jack."
"Yeah, I saw them."
"How much blood did you lose?"
"I'm all right," Wesley said. "They were just playing with us, hadn't begun feeding yet."
"Jack, are you okay?"
Jack wasn't entirely sure.
"Probably could use a butterfly bandage if you've got one."
He raised his hand and felt the warmth of liquid blood against his fingers.
"You're one of them," he said to Angel.
Angel turned away.
Right.
He sounded abashed.
"I am."
"Angel has a soul," Wesley said, as though that was some kind of explanation. When Angel turned back, he wore a human face again.
"There are more bandages in the car."
"He's a good vampire," Wesley continued patiently. And it was the first thing Jack had been able to wrap his head around since this evening had started. If the first prime of Apophis could throw his lot in with a ragtag bunch of Tauri, Jack supposed it stood to reason a vampire could befriend humans. As much as anything stood to reason tonight.
"Do you think this is another one of those mass hallucinations?" he asked hopefully.
"Sorry, pretty sure this is real," Angel said. He looked at Jack with new concern. "So how much blood have you lost?"
"Did you find Cordelia?" Wesley wanted to know.
"No sign of her.
According to the kid at the box office, nobody'd been at the theater all afternoon.
But that doesn't make any sense. What about the dress rehearsal?
It must have been called off. I want to stop back by the hotel, then head out to her place.
Can you get up, Jack?
No problem.
Jack hoped he wasn't about to be sick, and continued to sit right where he was until Wesley and Angel each took one of his arms and gently pulled him to his feet. He tried to ask about Daniel, but his tongue was thick in his mouth, and the world, which was already very dark, faded into a soothing shade of gray.
Quote, "Very slowly the wheels approached, and finally I could make out a vehicle moving along the street. It came nearer and nearer, and when it passed beneath my window, I saw it was a hearse. Then, as I trembled with fear, the driver turned and looked straight at me." End quote. The Yellow Sign, Robert W. Chambers, 1895. Something had gone badly awry. Paul was certain of that much, even if he couldn't put all the pieces together just yet. Things were in an SG-1-sized mess. Apophis warships were entering the solar system, or maybe replicators were going to eat the planet. At any rate, something bad was happening. And he really hoped Colonel O'Neill was on top of things, because Paul was only our man under the mountain. And although he would argue Stargate Command's case to the Pentagon as eloquently as he could, in the end, the responsibility simply didn't rest on his shoulders. That much was a tremendous relief, because honestly, he had no idea what to do. He wasn't even sure what was going on. Then he remembered Agent Katz. Katz was posted in D.C., he had no business being out here on the West Coast. His eyes flew open with a gasp of rage. Katz had actually pulled a gun and shot him, that son of a bitch. Paul's years as liaison to the SGC had taught him all about the occasional breach of protocol, but this... "Where is he?" Paul croaked. "You need to lie still," said a voice above him. "Stay calm, man. Everything's all right." "Not all right," Paul gasped furiously. His chest felt like someone was going after him with a sledgehammer. "I have to talk to Colonel O'Neill." The man above him chuckled sadly. Paul couldn't make out his face in the darkness. "I wouldn't mind seeing Colonel O'Neill either. He owes me dinner, did you know that? He showed up on Christmas Day at Jim's place, him and Teal'c and Major Carter, ate all the roast chicken and reshta pilau while I was so nervous and scared for Jim, I couldn't eat a bite." "Dr. Sandberg," Paul tried to say, but another swing of the sledgehammer against his ribs smashed his words to inarticulate bits. "Hey, easy. You've got to lie still. Don't try to talk." "I've been shot," Paul finally managed to whisper. "I know, but you're going to be all right. I promise." "Why did he do it?" "How would I know? They're your goons, aren't they?" Blair burst out. Then his gentle hand touched Paul's forehead. "Aw, man, don't pay any attention to me. I'm just a little freaked out here, that's all." "They came back for me," Paul insisted weakly. "Why would they do that?" Blair was silent. Paul had begun to suspect the sledgehammer was the beating of his own heart. The terrific pressure on his left side had to be the palm of Blair Sandberg's hand, pressing hard and trying to keep the blood in his body.
"Please," Paul whispered. "Tell me what you know."
Blair sighed unhappily. "First, you've got to be calm, and you've got to stop trying to talk. Deal?"
Paul nodded a tiny amount. He'd figured out they were in a moving vehicle, but they weren't going anywhere very fast. Sirens were blaring, and he saw the occasional flash of blue or red out of the corner of his eye.
"I don't know how much you remember, but you were trying to help me, and one of them turned around and shot you."
Blair's voice sank so low it nearly broke.
"They did it right in front of me, and you were..."
Paul felt the ends of Blair's hair falling in his face. He must have bowed his head.
"They were hustling me into the back of this van, and I was yelling at them, and after that, I really don't know. They went back and got you, and they even took my handcuffs off so I could try to help."
"And the rest of it?" Paul gasped.
"Major Davis, that's it. Paul, don't worry about it now. Just concentrate on staying calm and..."
No, Paul wasn't sure of much right now. But he knew for certain that Blair Sandberg wasn't telling him the whole story.
"I'm probably dying."
"Don't be crazy."
"I deserve to know the truth."
"Jesus," Blair whispered miserably. His hand continued to press hard against the side of Paul's chest, and the pain came down like walls of water, deep as the ocean. Paul cried out, knowing the crash of the waves would hide his voice. But when the water receded, he heard a man yelling himself hoarse. That was him, Paul thought, but he couldn't make himself stop.
"It's all right," Blair was chanting above him. He sounded scared out of his mind, but underneath his fear was a thread of calm, as though deep down, he knew he could make it better by the force of his will alone. Paul desperately wanted to believe him.
"It's all right. I'm here. It's all right."
When the pain ebbed enough for Paul to form words again, he said, "Tell me." His throat was burning, and more than anything, he wished he could have a drink of water.
"Whatever they're planning, we'll fight them," Blair whispered.
"I'll fight them, and I won't let go, and you'll be all right. They went back for you because one of them said..."
"He said they might need an extra."
"An extra?" Paul groaned, incredulous.
"In case Daniel Jackson doesn't survive long enough."
So they had Dr. Jackson, Paul thought despairingly. Almost certainly the colonel as well.
"Do you know what they meant?" Blair asked, his voice grim and quiet.
"What's Daniel supposed to do?"
"End the world?" Paul wondered.
He whispered, "If I'm the extra, what does that make you?"
He had an insane urge to laugh, and he might have done it, too, if he hadn't been so certain laughter would kill him.
"Second runner-up?"
Blair did laugh. It came out closer to a sob.
"I don't think so, man. One of them told me I was the dead man's switch."
It just figured that Cordelia would turn up like this, sweeping through the front door with an entire damned entourage in tow. No explanation at all, except, "Oh my God, do you have any idea what the traffic's like out there?" Gunshot to his feet.
"Jesus, Cordy, are you all right?"
"Any reason I shouldn't be?" There were half a dozen or more people with her, guys so pretty and so much smaller than life, they had to be actors. Women as lovely as Cordelia, dressed in jeans and the kind of white t-shirts you bought on Rodeo Drive.
"I think I've survived traffic jams on Hollywood Boulevard before now," she informed Gunn airily.
The most bewildering of her new friends were a couple of big guys in conservative business suits who were exploring the candlelit lobby of the Hyperion as though they owned the place.
"Angel and Wes are all looking for you."
Gunn eyed the strangers who seemed bent on making themselves entirely at home.
"We were worried with all the other crazy stuff going on."
"Crazy stuff?" Cordelia interrupted, lowering her voice significantly.
"There is no crazy stuff," she warned him. "It's just a blackout."
She raised her voice again.
"Anyway, I told everyone we could have the dress rehearsal here. We're going to set up in the courtyard. There should be enough light from the moon so we're not tripping over each other, don't you think? And would you mind finding some more candles? It's a little grim in here."
"Cordy." She looked around.
"Isn't Angel here?"
"I just told you. He and English are out looking for you."
Gunn found himself gritting his teeth to keep from yelling.
"We were worried."
"I was really hoping he could meet everyone. Oh well. Hey guys, this is Gunn. I told you about him, but really, he's all right."
Someone grabbed his hand and shook it.
"Such a pleasure," the beautiful stranger cooed. "You're just as authentic as Cordy promised."
"Oh, great. Cordelia." He pulled her away.
"Are you sure this is such a good idea? Seems like there's a hell of a lot of crazy-ass shit going down tonight."
"We don't want to impose," said one of the men in a suit.
"Oh, don't be silly," Cordelia protested. "This is perfect. Gunn thinks so, too."
"As long as you're sure," the man said. Then, in a slick, seamless gesture, he pulled a SIG from his shoulder holster and placed the muzzle squarely against Gunn's forehead.
"Easy, son," he said. "We'd rather not spill any blood in here just yet."
Gunn stared back, every muscle tensed and trembling. He was furious at himself for not having spotted the concealed weapon. So freaked out over those hallucinations earlier, he hadn't noticed the real threat until it was too late.
"Cordy," he said carefully.
"Get out of here. Just run like hell. He can't shoot both of us at the same time."
"That's cute, Gunn, really." Cordelia lowered her voice.
"But would you please try not to embarrass me in front of my colleagues?"
"It's the ambiance of the place," someone interrupted. "It's a shame this is just a rehearsal. Cordelia, don't you wish we could put on the whole show here?"
"Oh, I'd love to, but Angel would never go for it."
"Gunn, where did you say Angel was again?"
Gunn looked as far to the left as he could without turning his head, trying to see her face.
"He's out," he said, keeping his voice nice and level.
The muzzle was pressing against his forehead hard enough to hurt.
How about you, girl? Are you sure you're feeling all right?"
"Maybe just a touch of stage jitters," she whispered. "Don't tell anyone."
"Cordy."
"Get on your knees," directed the man with the SIG. "Do it real slow so I don't get nervous and blow your head off. That might give Miss Chase an even worse case of the jitters."
"Seriously, darling," Cordelia said as she moved out of Gunn's
restricted line of sight.
I think it would be wonderful to stage the show here, but where would we seat the audience?
Someone moved behind Gunn. He was aware of the body heat of a person standing too close.
The agent told you to get on your knees, boy, said the man behind him.
Then he cold-cocked him with a gun he must have pulled from his own holster.
Gunn's knees folded under him, and when he hit the ground, he curled into a ball, panting and trying to breathe around the explosion of red at the back of his skull. From across the room, he heard the bright, brittle ring of Cordelia's laughter.
"Oh, Gregor," she exclaimed. "You're positively unreal."
"I know you don't give a hang what happens to us," complained the would-be producer of The King in Yellow. "But there's no reason for you to be so damned bloody-minded about it. Can't you see the poor bastard has a dislocated shoulder?" Daniel would think later this should have been his first clue, but at the time he'd been too light-headed from pain and shock to think about much of anything but the imminent end of the world if he couldn't convince these idiots not to perform The King in Yellow.
2 minutes, the producer said. "Just lay him out on the floor for me, and as long as nothing's fractured, I can get him fixed up. Don't tell me it wouldn't be easier to move him if he weren't weaving and staggering around like a drunkard from the pain."
Daniel heard the smack of flesh on flesh and an outraged yelp from the producer.
"You didn't have to do that," Daniel tried to say.
It came out as a moan through his gag. The producer was clearer.
"Oh, very good," he finally said, his voice a little thick. "Just hit anyone who tries to help."
Daniel winced to himself, expecting to hear another blow, but instead, one of the men dragging him forward muttered, "What the hell?" and Daniel was dropped unceremoniously to the floor. The impact made the edges of the world go fuzzy, and when he was able to open his eyes again, the lights from flashlights and candles bled wetly across his vision.
"Over on his back," the producer said impatiently. "What kind of field training do you people get anyway?"
Roughly as Daniel was turned, he was grateful they didn't roll him over his bad shoulder.
"I'll need his hands free," the producer said. "Mine as well."
As one of the agents sliced through the plastic cuffs around Daniel's wrists, he wondered if this were some sort of escape attempt, and if the producer really expected him to be able to get up and run anywhere. The man dropped to his knees beside Daniel and pulled the gag out of his mouth.
"You ready?"
"Not really," Daniel whispered, trying to swallow.
"Can't say I blame you," the producer agreed. He raised his head. "One of you get down here and keep him still for me. Your hand on his good shoulder."
"Right, like that. Get a fistful of his shirt on the other side and hold it to the ground. A little further down his ribs. That should work." The agent who was bent over him stared down at Daniel, his face unreadable by candlelight. Daniel's shirt was stretched so tightly over his chest, it had begun to constrict his breathing.
"Scream if you have to," the producer told him with a cheerful lack of sympathy. "Won't bother me."
He bent Daniel's arm at the elbow and then began to pull. Daniel choked. His head went back, and his body jerked hard despite the agent's attempts to keep him still.
"Hold him," the producer snapped.
He began to turn Daniel's upper arm, rocking carefully, and the gritty drag of tendon over bone was unendurable.
Daniel squeezed his eyes shut and tried to keep breathing. He'd survived the unendurable before now. And besides, the producer almost had the joint in place again. Daniel could feel it. Muscle and tendons stretched to their limits in the instant before the bone finally shifted. And then, nothing at all. The producer stopped moving. God! Daniel began to repeat over and over in his head. Agony muddled his thoughts, and as the moment continued to lengthen, he felt as guilty as if he really were crying out to the Goa'uld. White fireworks burst behind his closed eyelids, and every throb of his pulse felt like slamming into a brick wall. This couldn't go on any longer. It couldn't. It would be over now. And now. Jesus, now. Please, he whimpered, but the producer continued to hold his arm motionless. Can you see it? He asked Daniel calmly. And Daniel didn't know which of them had become unhinged. But clearly it was one or the other, because Daniel couldn't see anything at all. Please, he moaned again, frantic for the producer to settle the joint into place, or just let him go. This endless, dragging tension was tearing him to shreds. His eyes flew open, and crouched above him was the king of rags and tatters. Daniel opened his mouth to shriek, but the air he dragged into his lungs was so foul with decay, he choked. The face lowered close to his was softly white and utterly featureless, and it spoke without a mouth. The sole mercy was that Daniel didn't know the language. He couldn't force his mind to stop trying to process what he heard, though, and like a man watching a corpse floating upwards out of murky waters, the language's deep syntactical structures began to take shape in his mind. When he began to recognize individual syllables, he felt reason tottering on her throne. They were words he had seen only hours before, logograms preserved in mankind's oldest writings. He tried to clamp his hands over his ears, but he couldn't move. He couldn't speak. He couldn't even close his eyes as soft gobbets of flesh shivered and rippled above him. Please, he said one last time, even though there was no one and nothing there to grant him mercy. And Catherine Langford said to him, Are these your parents? Foster parents, Daniel answered automatically. They're dead now. Catherine nodded and put away the photograph. Do you have time to listen to a story? She asked. I don't. Daniel looked around himself, vaguely confused. He had been in the middle of something important, he thought. Unpleasant, but important. Rain was pounding down on the roof of the limousine, and his luggage on the sidewalk was getting soaked. Yes, I suppose I do. Very well, then. This is a story about a very clever woman who married a very clever man, and together they went to live in a faraway land. They were so happy with each other, neither gave any thought to children. But in the fullness of time, the woman conceived and brought forth a baby boy all the same. Me, Daniel said softly. The baby boy was me. Catherine smiled at him. She and the clever man loved their son with all their hearts, for all that they had never prayed for a child. And the clever woman believed that her child would grow up to be very clever indeed, more wise than either she or her husband.
Alas, though, the clever woman and her husband finally came home from faraway lands. And here they died, leaving their son to grow to manhood as a friendless orphan, alone and unloved in the world.
I wasn't alone, Daniel disagreed quietly. I had mentors, friends.
He was so alone that when a stranger invited him to go to faraway lands himself, he went without a backward glance. He traveled through the sky and across the desert until at last he married the daughter of a king, and then he believed he would travel no more. But the clever woman's orphan child had a restless, grasping, greedy heart, and having seen how vast the universe was, after only a year with his beautiful wife, he longed to travel once more. No, I never wanted to leave Shari. That's not the way it was. Catherine continued as though he hadn't spoken at all. The clever woman came to her son in a dream, and in that dream she took the form of a little yellow bird sitting upon the branch of a cypress tree.
I never dreamed that, Daniel protested, but he had begun to tremble. That wasn't my mother.
The clever woman told her son that he would bring grief to everyone he loved if he rolled the stone away from the door. But her son thought himself far too clever to listen to advice from a little yellow bird. Daniel covered his face with his hands.
Please, he begged. I know what happened. I don't want to listen to this.
And so the clever woman's son rolled the stone away from the door, and he lost his beautiful wife, seeing her no more until she gave birth to a serpent. The serpent saw that his mother's husband was clever but feckless, tender-hearted but quick to anger, greedy for travel and knowledge and power. He came to the clever woman's son in a dream, taking the form of a young boy, and he warned him that he must roll the stone away from the door no more, or all that the clever woman's son loved would surely perish. The clever woman's son wept and promised he would not. But as the clever often think themselves too wise to keep promises, so he rolled the stone away from the door a second time.
No, Daniel said, I won't listen to this anymore.
And despite all that happened, the clever woman's orphan son has put his shoulder to the great stone and plans to roll it away for the third time, even if it means the end of the world.
Daniel turned away, fumbling at the latch and stumbling out into the pouring rain.
Cenotaphs stretched to the horizon, and the cypress trees were full of crows who screamed insults at him. He turned slowly, wondering how to get home, wondering if he even had a home any longer. And when he turned back, Jack was standing at his shoulder.
For crying out loud, Daniel, he snapped, exasperated. You trying to get your death of cold?
Daniel backed away, arms stretched out before him.
Keep away from me, Jack. I'll kill you sooner or later. You can't trust me. You can't believe anything I say.
Oh, yeah, Jack was unimpressed. And I'm the king of Siam.
What the heck's got into you?
He wasn't entirely sure himself.
I don't...
One thing still stood out vividly.
I never stopped loving Shari. I never would have opened the gate if I'd known what would happen. Never.
Ah, for the love of Mike. Jack reached out and dragged him into a rough hug.
You think I don't know that?
You think there's anyone around here who doesn't know that? He ruffled Daniel's wet hair with his hand and patted his cheek.
Come on, let's get you the hell out of the rain. You can come home with me, grab a hot shower. I'll throw some dinner together.
What do you say?
Daniel pulled back and looked at him. If the world ends tonight, will it be my fault?
Jack shrugged. Probably. But I always thought you'd be the death of us all sooner or later.
He tugged on Daniel's arm, and a warm flush of pain awakened Daniel to the unyielding floor beneath his back and the flashlights burning in his eyes. The ache in his shoulder went bone deep, but it was no longer unendurable. Whatever else had just happened, the producer must have succeeded in setting his arm.
Did I pass out?
His voice came out as a croak, and he couldn't see the faces of the men above him.
Well? Asked one of the agents.
Nothing, said the producer.
Sorry, gentlemen.
What do you mean, nothing?
I mean he hid behind some ludicrous, self-pitying fairy tale so impenetrable I never had a prayer of getting through. Either he's a tougher son of a bitch than you give him credit for, or he's so far round the bend he could give Ripper a run for the money in the neuroses department. He didn't give up a thing about the Tattered King, so all that slapping me around was for nothing. Thank you so very much.
The agent swore, but the producer said,
It doesn't matter. It's close now. I can feel it.
Your little problem with the Goa Uld should be history after tonight.
You bastard! Daniel groaned, furious and betrayed. Who are you?
Oh, one thing I did get from him. I think Dr. Jackson wouldn't have fancy a back scuttle from his commanding officer, for what that's worth. It really is a shame you didn't grab Colonel O'Neill when you had the chance.
Quote, There was a time in which there existed nothing but darkness and an abyss of waters, wherein resided most hideous beings, which were produced of a twofold principle. There appeared men, some of whom were furnished with two wings, others with four, and with two faces. Bulls, likewise, were bred there with the heads of men, and dogs with fourfold bodies, terminated in their extremities with the tails of fishes. Horses also with the heads of dogs, men too, and other animals, with the heads and bodies of horses and the tails of fishes. In short, there were creatures in which were combined the limbs of every species of animals. In addition to these, fishes, reptiles, serpents, with other monstrous animals, which assumed each other's shape and countenance. End quote. Fragments of Chaldean History, Berossus, from Alexander Polyhistor. I.P. Corey Translation, 1832. The street was still crowded with cars, but the sidewalk had begun to clear as people finally made their way to home and shelter. Jim found Major Paul Davis's blood congealing on the concrete half a block away from the Indian restaurant. The bullet didn't hit an organ, he said, his voice tight. And it's probably still in him. Major Carter trained her flashlight on the bloodstains, and Jim looked away up into the night sky. The moon had turned red from the smoke in the air. How can you possibly know that? She asked. Organs smell. She didn't flinch. What I meant was, how can you be sure this is Paul's blood? Do you smell blood types? How is that possible? Jim shrugged, vaguely nostalgic for the old days. Keeping this sentinel business a secret had been less trouble than the explanations. Sandberg has theories about how much I'm able to process sensory input on a molecular level. Mostly I try not to think about it too much.
Tilk had knelt to examine the bloodstains, and Jim stepped away from him. Speaking of things he didn't want to think about. It wasn't getting any easier to ignore the sounds of the creature Tilk carried inside him. The thing shifted, squelching and pushing like a baby in the womb, and it smelled like the mud from the bottom of a swamp, or like the insides of a gutted catfish. But I know this is Major Davis's blood because I heard him get shot.
Do you know why?
Tilk asked, rising to his feet.
Why they shot him? Because he was trying to help Sandberg, Jim answered bleakly. What does the NID want with him?
I don't know, Major Carter said. Are you sure they were NID? With everything that's been going on tonight.
I'm sure. You can track them, Tilk announced calmly.
What do you think I've been trying to do all along? Jim did not say. He'd been pushing as hard as he dared, but if he lost himself now, he'd be no use to Blair. No, I can't, he told Tilk. We'll have to follow them the old-fashioned way. Hope we can catch up to them in traffic.
Dr. Sandberg and Major Davis can't be more than a mile away, Tilk said. In his dissertation, Blair Sandberg documents instances where you have found people over considerably greater distances.
Not tonight, he said shortly, turning around and stalking away. I'm getting the car. You want help? You can come with me. Otherwise, I'll do it myself. Detective Ellison, Jim. Carter stood in his way. Of course we're coming with you. But Paul could be bleeding to death even as we speak. If there's even a chance, your abilities could even the odds.
There isn't. Not now. Not like this. You are afraid to try, Tilk announced.
There was no point in getting angry. You have no idea what you're asking me to do.
Perhaps not. It is necessary all the same. If you attempt to calm and distance yourself from your emotional reaction to this night's events, I believe you will be able to focus past the smell of burning chemicals and the multitudinous sounds of a frightened populace, and find Blair Sandberg and Major Davis.
That's what you believe, Jim answered flatly.
They are both in dire need of your assistance, and what is more, I am certain Blair Sandberg thinks you will use your abilities to help him now. He has, after all, spent the last 4 years of his life teaching you to control them.
The man just didn't know when to give up. If only the problem really were a little smoke and noise.
I am going to find Sandberg. I just don't need these senses to do it.
That is not a reasonable response.
Tilk put his hand on Jim's shoulder, and Jim whirled furiously, knocking Tilk's arm away. Completely unfazed, Tilk continued. I can help you achieve a meditative state which will allow you to use your senses to your greatest ability, even under these circumstances.
You don't understand. On the flight down, Sandberg was terrified. He told me I couldn't risk zoning or even light meditation while I was here because the, whatever it is, the darkness was so close.
Even talking about it made Jim more aware of the emptiness that was slowly crowding out existence. If I lose myself in that, I won't be able to help Sandberg.
Jim imagined himself catatonic, or worse, utterly helpless while Blair was in the hands of the NID. He wouldn't risk abandoning Blair like that, even if this was the end of the world. He couldn't.
"I will not permit you to lose yourself to the darkness," Tilk said.
"And what makes you think you could stop it?"
"I have spent most of my life learning to meditate in the presence of evil."
Tilk placed the palm of his hand over his own belly. Jim heard the thing inside him move, and even after everything that had happened tonight, he felt a frisson of pure horror.
"You communicate?"
Tilk inclined his head slightly.
"It is aware of me as I am of it. It would destroy me if it could."
Jim looked to Carter, skeptical, scientific Major Carter, who didn't believe Jim could differentiate blood types. Her lips were pressed tightly together, but her eyes were soft with sympathy. She believed every word Tilk was saying.
"It's not the same thing. It couldn't be."
"Nor is it entirely dissimilar. Detective Ellison, if you trust me, I believe I can be your guide in this."
Jack knew this place. The lobby was straight out of old Hollywood. Marble tiles as slick as death. A grand staircase sweeping up to the mezzanine as though just waiting for the chorus line. Palm trees in pots. Through glass doors, Jack could see an open courtyard where a fountain glittered and splashed in the sunlight. People were everywhere, in the lobby, out in the courtyard, their voices an undifferentiated drone, save for the occasional sparkle of laughter. As Jack made his way around the edges of the crowd, he scanned the faces for someone he knew, but everyone was a stranger to him. Just as well, really, because it wasn't as though he had time to stand around making idle conversation. Not when Daniel was waiting upstairs. He impatiently punched the elevator button twice, watching the reflections of the people behind him in the brass elevator doors. Their images were ghostly, slipping like spirits across the polished surface, and it was a relief when the doors finally opened. He scooted in, and when he turned around, the lobby was filled with monsters. They lowed and bleated, hissed and mewled. Human features and limbs emerged from furred and feathered bodies like cancerous excrescences. A toad with a single bright blue eye on the top of its head blinked up at Jack from the marble floor. A lamb, still bloodied and wet from its birthing, staggered behind, struggling to push itself upright on slender black human forearms.
"God, let this be a dream," Jack prayed as he fell backwards, hitting the back wall of the elevator hard as the doors finally closed. If there was anything holy left in the universe, this had to be just another dream. But in the millions of years it took the elevator to reach Daniel's floor, Jack forgot his hope that none of this was real, and he began to beat his fist against his thigh in an agony of impatience. Daniel had probably fallen asleep waiting for him. He would have no idea the world had cracked wide open, and the inhabitants of hell were teeming across the surface. All alone in a lousy room in a haunted hotel, innocently trusting that Jack would take care of him. When the elevator doors opened, Jack heard a faint tune floating down the dark corridor. Irving Berlin. He ran. The dark flowers on the carpets twined around his feet, and the vines on the darker wallpaper reached out for him on either side. The electric wall sconces flickered like candlelight, and the corridor grew longer as he ran. But Jack was indefatigable, pushing harder even when the air became as thick as molasses, even when gravity itself seemed to be dragging him down to the writhing floor. It was like trying to run on P3X-636. And the instant he thought that, he found himself standing at the door of Daniel's room. He felt for his keys before realizing the door wasn't quite closed. Jack's every instinct screamed for him to immediately fling the door open wide and go to Daniel. But he forced himself to sidle up as quietly as he could and put his ear to the panels first. When he heard nothing but a faint rustling, he gently pushed open the door. The first thing he saw was Daniel, curled on his side in bed, his back turned, and the sheets pulled up almost to his bare shoulder. The lamp was on, and a small yellow book lay on the bedside table. Jack breathed a soul-deep sigh of relief and turned to lock the door behind himself. Then it occurred to him to wonder, if Daniel were sound asleep, just what he had heard rustling in the bedroom. He turned back. Something was in bed with Daniel, huddled under the sheets on the far side of the bed, lumpy and bunched up, like a person rolled up into a tight ball, except somehow, not quite. Jack inched forward, his mind on the unspeakable creatures filling the lobby downstairs. "Daniel," he whispered, heartsick. "Daniel, for the love of God." The thing beside Daniel awoke first, uncurling from beneath the sheets, and then emerging from the bedclothes in a fury, violently jostling Daniel as it tried to clamber upright. It had a man's face and shoulders, and the hindquarters of a boar, bloated genitalia hanging between its haunches, and cloven hooves tearing at the carpet. Daniel lay motionless, looking up at the ceiling and blinking, no expression on his face at all. Jack lunged forward and dragged Daniel out of bed and away from the monstrosity that stamped its hooves and screamed in frustration because it couldn't stand upright. As Jack backed away, Daniel's head hanging and his feet dragging on the floor, the creature's arms crooked and lengthened, growing into vast, leathery wings. Still roaring, it shook its head so violently its features blurred and disappeared, and suddenly there were two heads shaking and screaming upon the corrupt memory of human shoulders. Then four, each facing a separate direction and shrieking in its own tongue. Daniel was a dead weight in his arms, slipping further down the more tightly Jack tried to hold him. He pleaded as he fought to hold him, begging Daniel to snap out of it, to help Jack get them both out of here. The unspeakable perversion which had crawled out of Daniel's bed had finally managed to stand nearly erect. It had eight wings now. They beat wildly, covering and uncovering each of its faces in turn. All but stupefied with horror, it occurred to Jack that he'd never suspected the sight of the tattered king had actually been a mercy, shielding them from what lay beyond. Then Jack was floundering his way back to consciousness, the night air cold on his face. "Daniel," he said, and a warm hand came down over his mouth to silence him. "Quiet," Wyndham Price whispered urgently. "You lost more blood than we realized, but I think you're going to be all right." Jack rolled his eyes back to look at the night sky overhead. He could hear the nearby roar of traffic. When Wesley finally lifted his hand, Jack said, "We've got to find Daniel." "We have," Angel said from the front seat. Wesley helped him sit upright. Jack's head spun, but when he could finally focus, he saw they were half a block down and across the street from the Hyperion. Two cars were parked in the half-loop at the front entrance. By the harsh glare of their headlights, he could see four men surrounding a fifth who walked very slowly, his head bowed. Daniel. A moment later, and they had disappeared into the hotel. "Is there a delivery entrance?" Jack immediately demanded. "A place that size. There's got to be a way in through the basement, some place they won't know to guard." "Take it easy," Angel said infuriatingly. "I've got it covered. They've got Gunn and Cordelia in there, too." "Angel and I will go in and take care of them," Wesley announced. "But if there's anything you know about those men that you're not telling us..." "There's something you're not telling me," Jack interrupted. He was already forgetting the details of his dream, which he could hardly regard as anything but a mercy. But the gist of it remained cold and clear as ice. "What is it that makes your damn office space ground zero for the apocalypse?"